do you know about Aboriginal culture in the early period after British settlement? My last guest today, historian and archaeologist Paul Irish, says the only time the subject came up in his own schooling was when he learned about the First Fleet, and he remembers, and I quote him, something about Bennelong, Manly, Spearings and smallpox. But there's a lot more to the history of the Indigenous people in our cities than that. It was widely believed that when Governor Phillip and the early settlers erected their tent city in Sydney Cove, local Aboriginal people were either turfed out or killed off. Nothing could be further from the truth. In his absorbing new work, Hidden in Plain View, Paul Irish highlights that in the century after colonisation, the children and grandchildren of the First Peoples continued to live in Sydney, not its outskirts. They camped in the Domain and Double Bay, bathed at Bondi, and held ritual combats in Hyde Park. And although Indigenous people remain markedly absent from colonial narratives of the time, the people of coastal Sydney were actually living here all along, as Paul Irish puts it, hidden in plain view, and I welcome him now. I'm glad you could join us.
Yes, thanks, Geraldine. Thanks for having me.
And Paul, look, we will be talking about specifically Sydney here because that's been your research, but do you think this you can extrapolate this to other parts of Australia?
Yes, I think every city has its own set of circumstances that dictated exactly what went on, but certainly it is true that every colonial city in Australia has an Aboriginal history to it that has really flown under the radar. I guess there's elements of it that we know. In Sydney, for example, we've heard of people like Bennelong and Bungaree, and in each city there will be some story like that. But when you want to go a bit deeper than that and look at the continuities, people's knowledge just drops off very suddenly. And
so what got you involved?
I think, well, I trained as an archaeologist and I was working with Aboriginal people around Sydney, and we were looking for Aboriginal sites, traces of sort of ancient Aboriginal presence in Sydney. But I was talking to people, particularly living around the coast, who had direct ancestry back to that time. And I was discovering that while we were looking for these ancient traces of them in the landscape, there was nothing being done about the history of those people since 1788. It was as if we were looking for some ancient past and forgetting that it had any connection to the present. And so I started to get interested and read a lot of things. There's been plenty of other people who've been looking at this history over many years. But I think what's been missing in Sydney, and certainly in other cities as well, is a sort of overarching story about why people were there, how were they there, what were the things that enabled them to stay in a place that they were long thought to have been evicted from or forced out of.
Yeah, and if I do my job well, I'll draw out the really quite the nuances that you've brought out of this, which is you've spent 10 years putting this together, didn't you? So it clearly captured you, and you did. What was it that you started to believe was the great silence? Stan Grant's written a foreword to your book.
I think it's a combination of things. It's not necessarily some sort of conspiracy of silence. I think it's just that we've gotten so used to telling ourselves stories that cities were white spaces and they grew at the expense of the Indigenous people that were there. We've just gotten so used to that, and also of thinking about the concept of authenticity. We either think that Aboriginal people were forced away, or we have this view that, well, they weren't really
defeated.
Yeah,
completely.
They weren't really Aboriginal anymore because they started speaking English and wearing clothes, European clothes and things. And that's a really unhelpful way to look at things. I mean, I work with the descendants of people who were around when the First Fleet arrived, and they are still proudly Aboriginal, as have every generation of their families been since as long as anyone knows.
Even though they may have a lot of intermarriage in their groups?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not that they don't acknowledge their sort of different ancestries. It's also not that they would pretend that they were living the same way as their ancestors in 1788, but they identify very strongly not only as Aboriginal people but with Sydney specifically. And I think that's, if you trace back each generation doing that, you've got to say, well, at what point did people cease to become authentic? They're obviously still Aboriginal. It's just they don't live the way that they did 200 years ago. I mean, neither do we, you know, in our lives.
And you're seeking to challenge this. I think you have a bit pretty broad brief that's seeking to challenge the notion that there is one, that you have to go back almost to live on remote settlements to be a true Aboriginal person.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, you don't. And I mean, just by way of example, one of my favourite stories from Sydney is a man who was interviewed in the 1930s remembering his childhood in Rose Bay in the 1870s, so this is sort of nearly a century after the First Fleet, and he recalled a group of Aboriginal people spearfishing from the rocks at Rose Bay, and they were using their traditional pronged fishing spears, but with the prongs swapped out for umbrella spokes. Now, that's a perfect example of that's adaptation. Continuity and adaptation. Everyone else in the world is allowed to do it. Why do we think that Aboriginal people can't without losing authenticity? I mean, that obviously there's a lot of things that were lost. We can't pretend that losing language is not a terrible thing, but is that the only element of identity? You know, I think there are questions that we need to ask.
So how many Aboriginal people were actually living in Sydney and its coastal region when Governor Phillip dropped anchor?
Well, we don't know. I think the best guesses, and they are just guesses, would suggest that there was maybe 1,000, 1,500 people, something like that. But it depends on the area specifically that you define. And the real answer is that we don't know. I mean, there could be double that. It could be slightly less. You know, we don't know. But what we do know is that in 1789, just over 12 months after the First Fleet weighed anchor, there was a horrific smallpox epidemic that did kill a lot of people around Sydney. And the epicentre of that was Sydney Harbour and Botany Bay and those areas. So we know that throughout the 19th century, in the sort of century after that time, there's only about 50 to 100 Aboriginal people living around that same area. Now, whether you can directly equate that with 90% of people losing their lives through smallpox, or, I mean, we just don't know, but we certainly are talking about a much reduced population.
You've actually got here that virtually every single family in the Sydney area would have been affected, possibly entire families lost. Is that white and Aboriginal people?
No, this was something that the tragedy of this was that that Aboriginal people had no sort of background immunity to this disease, whereas Europeans had been exposed to it before. It's possible that some Europeans died. I don't think so. Or if they did, it was very small numbers. But for Aboriginal people, I mean, one of the First Fleeters described bodies sort of strewn around the harbour, and his quote was something like, as if the dead were left to bury the dead. You know, there just wasn't enough people to even bury the dead. And but I think whilst we should never ignore that tragedy, it has come at the expense of remembering what happened with the survivors. And
what did happen with the survivors?
Well, they stayed in Sydney and they kept living around Sydney.
So they weren't on remote farms? Because I think that's the general view, that they were pushed out to the outskirts.
And no, yeah, we find them, you know, 100 years after the smallpox epidemic, we find them living in amongst suburban Sydney, places like Rushcutters Bay, Rose Bay, in the Domain, as you mentioned, and certainly around Botany Bay. And not only were they living sort of next door to Europeans, but they had relationships often. They set up businesses to take advantage of things like pleasure ground hotels that were set up around Botany Bay for people to come for the weekend and, you know, have a day out from Sydney. Aboriginal people were there with their fishing boats offering tours around Botany Bay and being guides on hunting trips. They found ways to make a living and stay within Sydney.
So they were involved in the commerce of the early colony.
Yes, and I guess this is one of the really key factors in Sydney particularly, is that the coastal part of Sydney, fishing is just so integral to Aboriginal life, and they were able to continue fishing, which meant that they had a source of food but also a source of income. And as it turned out, quite early on, they discovered they had an expertise that was very sought after. Mm. And Aboriginal people were acknowledged as being the experts in terms of knowing where fish were and how to catch them.
And look, I must just ask you before we close that it was the children of convicts, you suggest, who developed very good relationships with Aboriginal people. Tell us some of the highlights of that.
Yeah, well, so we're talking about 50 to 100 Aboriginal people. We're not necessarily talking about every European child of a convict having a relationship with them, but there was a key group of people who grew up hunting and fishing with Aboriginal people in the early 19th century. And by the mid 19th century, they were quite influential business people, lawyers, newspaper editors, all sorts of people. And there's, I guess, two ways that they interacted. One was that some of them, like the Wentworth family, who owned the entire suburb of Vaucluse as part of their Vaucluse estate, and their extended family all had personal relationships with Aboriginal people living in that area, and they interacted with them, you know, fairly regularly. And the other is that there were sort of business relationships and other personal relationships. One of my favourite stories is a man named Charles Smith, who was a convict turned businessman and owned a butcher shop opposite the Sydney Markets, which is the QVB today. And he had very close relationships with Aboriginal people, and particularly one group from Sydney. And when their leader died in 1844, later that year he held a big feast at the back of his house on George Street and invited dozens of Aboriginal people from Sydney, treated them to a sort of Christmas feast, gave them all a suit of clothes. And we'd really like to know what would have happened with that relationship. He actually died himself a couple of weeks later, suddenly in his 40s. But people like that could have a huge role, because they were small numbers of people could be very influential in a small population like that.
Well, look, we'll leave people to discover how things changed when the authorities started to really get involved. When it was just the citizenry, it seems really things went along quite reasonably, and then the authorities got involved and the situation changed. But Paul Irish, thank you for devoting so much of your life to it, and I congratulate you.
Thanks, children.
Paul Irish, Hidden in Plain View, The Aboriginal People of Coastal Sydney, and it's a New South publication.